This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we're joined by a few of our regular panelists. First of all, we have Jim.
Good evening.
And we have Tom.
Hey, what's up, guys?
And the talented Mrs. Larson, Zilpha.
Hello.
And tonight we have one that I've been really looking forward to. We have the one and only Jeff Lindsay. How are you doing tonight, Jeff?
I'm doing very well, but however, there are several Jeff Lindsays, just to correct you.
Oh, you're not the one and only?
Yeah, I was going to say, are we going to talk about Dexter tonight? Or
exactly. I get a lot of fan mail saying, oh, your books on serial killers are so great. I wish I were getting some of the royalties.
Now,
I actually have a book that just got published, a nonfiction book, and it's caused plenty of confusion to have two Jeff Lindsays, both. I won't even go into it, but there's also a Jeff Lindsay soccer player and a few other Jeff Lindsays around the world. So, to all you Jeffs out there, hello.
Well, Jeff, the reason that we brought you on, other than that you're a fascinating guy, is that you have had kind of a long internet career as being kind of a hallmark Mormon apologist. Would you agree with that assessment?
I've been categorized as that, sure.
So, we were talking a little while ago, and one of the things that I said to you is, on this podcast and in a lot of places on the internet, apologists tend to be defined by their enemies, in that we have talked about apologists quite a bit in sort of a negative light. Or as kind of the, I wouldn't say negative as much as kind of the scapegoat. So tonight, what I'd really like to do is hear it from the other side. So maybe to start out our discussion, what do you think makes someone an apologist as opposed to just a regular member? And maybe you don't think there is a difference.
Sure. Well, I like to think of the term apologist in its more positive sense, as in, early Christian apologists or people that were defending the faith. And the term apologist, of course, as you all know, really means one who defends the faith. It can be done with reason and tact, and it can be done with a lot of blunders along the way. And I have made plenty of blunders. I will gladly admit that. The problem with apologetics in many people's minds is that people are unwilling to reason or consider other points of view, or to or that they might distort reality in ways that are really offensive. And that's a real challenge. I mean, you have to realize anyone defending any religion is taking on a pretty difficult task, because in the world's eyes, and in the eyes of our modern culture especially, anything tainted with religion is has this immaterial element, or the spiritual element, or this element that seems to defy the plane of reality. How can you believe in God when we can't see him? So just the fact that you believe in God makes you, in a sense, an outcast from the plane of reason. And you cannot, no one can adequately defend a religion relying solely on logic and things that you can prove and deduce plainly, irrefutably, because there always is some element of the unknown, of the unseen, of faith present. And that makes it difficult and challenging if your expectations are to defend clearly, reasonably, with logic. It's a difficult task. So what makes an apologist, though? An apologist, an LDS apologist, is someone who has strong faith, strong experiences regarding the authenticity of the religion, and is willing to stand up and defend it. And while we recognize that you can't prove so much of what we believe, there are many objections that can be answered, or at least there is the opportunity to refute some of the major challenges that some people throw out. Refute, or at least provide opportunity that maybe there is something there. Maybe there is a possibility of plausibility. Maybe the case against faith in God or faith in the Latter-day Saint viewpoint or faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ, maybe the case against those things is not so slam dunk after all. And so the real role of an apologist is to invite people to keep thinking, praying, pursuing, exploring, as opposed to closing their minds and walking away. So, because properly viewed, the role of the apologist is not to convert people or shatter opposition or provide some bright, sparkling case that draws people in and makes them naturally want to get baptized. It is to give people the hope to continue looking or the cause to continue exploring with the possibility then that they will find out, have their own encounter, their own discovery, that they can help see things the way that we might see them from the perspective of faith. So it's not to prove, it's not to convert, it is to extend the grounds for hope, I guess, or almost give more time for the Spirit to work, is how some people might view it, to help people see that there may be some basis for belief so they can move to the next level.
Hey, Jeff, this is Tom. I appreciate you being willing to come on and talk with us. Because I've gone through your website, and it's a fascinating website with a lot of research and a lot of well-documented things. How did you get interested in kind of becoming a defender of Mormonism and spending the time and the energy to be an apologist of sorts? Some people don't just fall into apologetics per se. How did Right. you get involved?
A large part of what has motivated me over the years is seeing what I feel to be unnecessary pain in people's lives, where people abandon hope, abandon God, leave the church, or do other things that I feel are serious mistakes based on, or at least partially driven by, or maybe it was the straw that broke the camel's back, but in some sense based upon objections that helped shatter their faith, or as Michael Lash would put it, gave them this shaken faith syndrome. And I think that's a fascinating book that Michael has written, by the way, not to put in too many plugs, but that's an interesting work he's done. Seeing some people make what I felt were very tragic mistakes or sad mistakes, based on maybe unwarranted conclusions or unfair conclusions or misinterpretations of evidence and data and so forth. I felt like, boy, it would really help if someone could answer some of those things. I think part of what really got me going was to my surprise finding out that so much, you know, I grew up largely out west in Idaho, Utah, a little bit in Oregon, but you know, when I was a teenager, it really came as a surprise to me to see that significant ministers in large denominations were teaching their congregations that we weren't even Christian. And I was just in shock. See, how could anyone say that? I mean, we spent our lives learning about Christ, praying in His name, studying the gospel of Christ, teaching about Christ, preaching about Christ, and now we have these people telling us we're not even Christian. You know, things like that were just really kind of shocking to me and kind of fueled me as a teenager to kind of stand up and speak out when some of my good friends who were, one of whom was a very vocal anti-Mormon, would, you know, openly challenge the faith. And I felt like, you know, someone's got to stand up and at least let people know that he might not be 100% right in what he's saying. And so it was probably as a teenager, I started thinking, wow, there's a need for people to at least stand up and answer some of these basic objections. And it was at that point where I also experienced the negative side of apologetics, where in my, you know, zeal to help defend the gospel, I found myself, and it took me a while to realize this, but I found myself throwing out some popular arguments and so-called evidence sentences that ended up being very inappropriate. One of my parents had somehow gotten a hold of a book, or someone had given it to them. It was called something like 31 Evidences for the Book of Mormon, something from the 50s or 60s probably. And it had all these little paragraphs without documentation, without scholarship, saying, you know, how bushels of arrowheads and weapons were found in the hill Cumorah, signifying that some great huge battle had happened there. And in that area, thousands of bushels of arrowheads had been dug up and plowed up by the farmers. And that's not true. It took me a while to realize that some of these statements made in this irresponsible book that I had quoted in it to some friends in high school in my defense of the gospel were really not correct. And that was very painful and embarrassing to realize that I'd been spouting off things that really, really didn't make sense. And that is a process that I think all of us, whatever position you're taking in life, whether it's in religion or in politics, healthcare reform, whatever it is, that I think we all need to routinely evaluate our position and the things we use to defend it, and realize that we need to weed some things out. We may be taking positions that don't really fit. And we've got to be revising things. And it was kind of a painful process to realize that there are a lot of sources trying to defend, the gospel or Christianity or belief in God that can be irresponsible, and not everything can be trusted. And it's an ongoing process. And there are probably things I might say this week that 5 years from now I'll look back and say, you know, nope, I've got to quit using that source and don't use that example. That's not right. And maybe I'll make a major revision in my interpretation of the gospel, in fact, because we all have a lot to learn. But that was kind of my start. Teenage years, high school, faded off for a long time, went on a mission, and coming back into college and getting married, running into Hugh Nibley, he was in my ward, got me really excited about some of the possibilities of the excitement, the intellectual excitement that can be in the gospel. And you don't have to live in a cave and give up your brain to savor the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, in my mind, in spite of all its human flaws. I mean, not the gospel's human flaws, but the human flaws of the church and its people. There are some remarkably intellectually exciting, challenging, satisfying aspects of the restored gospel, in my opinion, that listening to Hugh Nibley and some of the people that were in his circles really got me excited. And that's been, to me, a fascinating journey. And one that I feel like can be meaningful to people both in and out of the church.
My question to you, Jeff, would be, while you started to kind of become a scholar of sorts in Mormonism, and you started to understand a little bit more of the semi-troublesome or even some of the major troublesome issues in Mormon history, did you ever experience for yourself kind of a crisis of faith that you've obviously seen other people go through?
Yes, no, absolutely, and I think we have to confront the fact that there are issues in any faith and in many aspects of our faith that really can shake us up, and I think it's healthy to recognize that and to confront them and face them in some way. For me, there are some issues that still trouble me to this day. I mean, there's no good way of portraying some of the difficult, challenging events that we've been through in modern or in church history, or even going all the way back to Old Testament history. And there are a lot of things in the Old Testament that I just really shake my head and wonder what was going on there. But for me, the one that I think was a real defining moment was the Book of Abraham. The basic presentation from what I consider to be the anti-Mormon side of Joseph Smith completely bungling it, how it was, you know, the story that he could get away with with this bogus translation in the 1830s, but now that we can read Egyptian, well, we thought the documents were gone, but voila, they've now been covered in 67, and here they are. We can read them plainly. We can translate them, and there's nothing about Abraham.
You're referring to the Book of Abraham, not necessarily the Book of Mormon, correct?
Oh, yes. If I said Book of Mormon, I meant Book of Abraham.
You said Book of Abraham.
Okay. So, yes, I'm referring to the Book of Abraham. And, I was carefully reading through what, the Tanners had written about it and the arguments that were presented. It's a very compelling case. And it's so compelling that some very good people have left the church. And one of my blog posts on Mormanity, mormanity.org is where I blog, that's gotten a lot of hits, I would say, is titled "Cutting a Little Slack for Ex-Mormons." And it's a blog post recognizing that just because someone has left the church, that doesn't mean that they have a drug addict or a sex fiend or were offended by someone, in some trivial way at church that some people assume happens, that there are good intellectual people for reasonable, logical reasons deciding, hey, I've got to switch gears and leave the church. And some of the people that have left the church remain very dear friends of mine, and they're very intelligent, wonderful people, and some of them know who they are, and hello, if you're listening. And I think we need to recognize that just because they have left the church does not mean they are to be feared and loathed and assumed that they have, some terrible social disease or something. And I can see why people have gotten really disturbed by the Book of Abraham evidence. At that time, I was bishop. I was bishop of the Appleton Second Ward here in Appleton, Wisconsin. And that was a pretty significant moment for me to say, oh my goodness, at that point, I went to the Lord in prayer and said, my experiences with the Book of Mormon and its evidences and its power and its spirit and what it's done for my life, give me a very, very strong testimony that the Book of Mormon is from God. But Lord, what happened to the Book of Abraham? Did Joseph just blow it? Did something go wrong? Is the church not true because of it? And I prayed very sincerely and very much language very similar to that. And my personal experience in prayer at that point was just be patient. And that's unfortunately been the answer to many of my prayers in life, either no or be patient or what are you asking that for? When I ask for big things, that's often the answer. When I ask for the small things or things that might help me bless someone else's life in a minor way, they're much more likely to be answered favorably. But in this case, it was be patient. And I started digging into things and trying to read and understand a little more about the history of these the papyrus rolls and fragments and so forth. And as I dug into it, I realized it was a very, very important realization that the arguments that were presented were very carefully tailored. And while they were very persuasive, they were, to me, this is my opinion, fundamentally deceptive in presenting the alleged fact that the papyrus fragments that Joseph Smith translated for the Book of Mormon had been found, and now we can translate them. The reality is some fragments from this collection of scrolls did survive and have been found, but there were also a much larger collection of written documents that were part of this original collection that were probably the documents used or may well have been the documents used to translate the Book of Abraham. That collection ended up going to, to Missouri and then to Chicago, where unfortunately, as far as we can tell, was burned in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. But we have numerous witnesses, both LDS and non-LDS, who describe the papyrus fragments that Joseph Smith used and called the Book of Abraham. And they are described in terms that don't fit the remnants that have been found. And there's some prima facie evidence for questioning whether those particular fragments really comprise the scroll that Joseph Smith translated as the Book of Abraham. Those little facts, those details that weaken the argument were left out completely. And I felt like I was cheated by not being told that, well, there's also this alternate explanation and these may have just been a tiny part of a much larger collection that's no longer present. and on. And then I realized, once I realized that some people are, you know, the anti-apologist, willing to go to extremes to present their view of the world or to put the facts the way they see it, to tell the story they want to tell, I realized you really need to be cautious. Just as you need to be cautious with evidence that appears to support the church, you need to be cautious with the evidence that appears to attack it. Dig in, explore, question.
Jeff, I mean, what you're stating, and let me just make sure this is what you're stating, is that it is the critics of the church who are going to extremes in order to prove their case. It is not the apologists who are going to extremes to prove their case.
Now,
is that what you're stating?
There's extremism on both sides, and there are serious mistakes on both sides. And I've made serious mistakes, and if I were to go through my website and read things, I've got things on there that have been out there for 4 or 5 years, I might have different ways of finding it. And it's a challenge to go through. And I appreciate it when people point things out to me and say, Jeff, this looks wrong, or have you thought about this? And I do try to listen to those comments and make revisions. I'm way behind in email, but we're all subject to mistakes. But for me, it was important to realize that this weak, the weak underbelly of Mormonism, the Book of Abraham, when I looked at it, not only did I find that some of the arguments critics made were very deceptive, and I felt deliberately deceptive. As I explored it further, I found to me some very intellectually very exciting aspects of the Book of Abraham, and especially looking at Joseph Smith's interpretation of some of the facsimiles, for example, and what these characters mean, this upside down characters called the Sons of Horus, or his interpretations of those figures. And was a very exciting thing. And seeing how the critics tried to spin it or tried to walk away from that was also an interesting experience to me. And now with so there's been some very interesting scholarship on, you know, ancient documents that tell different aspects of the Abraham story from many different traditions, and finding some fascinating parallels between these ancient documents that weren't available, largely were not available in Joseph Smith's day, and the text of the Book of Abraham itself, coupled with some of the, I feel, compelling evidences for at least something going on, in terms of his translation of facsimile 2 and other facsimiles. It's gone from being an embarrassment to maybe a puzzlement with some interesting and, I feel, intellectually exciting elements that we can savor. Doesn't mean all the questions have been answered. It doesn't mean, you know, it's a slam dunk case either way, but it's worthy of scholarship and not worthy of somebody necessarily folding and walking away from the church because of the unanswered questions. So that was a journey for me, and as a result of that, I wrote up, now have 3 or 4 pages on the Book of Abraham on my website at jefflindsay.com, where I share some of the things that I feel are relevant or that need to be considered. And that was a fascinating journey for me. There are other areas where you, as people often say, you just have to still be patient, or I don't have good answers. I don't mean to give the impression that I feel like there are answers to every objection or question or awful thing that's happened. I don't have those answers. But there are some very exciting finds and things that I think are worthy of our attention.
So putting aside the Book of Abraham for a little bit, you know, you've been at this for a long time. What do you think are some of the sillier or stranger arguments that critics use against the church?
Wow. Well, no, there are quite a few. I'm surprised to still see that the weight of the Book of Mormon being such a big issue that's still circulating and gets a lot of attention. How could Joseph Smith have carried a 200-pound book, or run through the woods carrying it? It's a very interesting question, because yes, it would have been 200 pounds if it were a solid block of gold, but these were thin metal leaves, and there's going to be airspace between them. And you start calculating for, you know, a set of thin leaves, or foil-like material, amount of airspace you're likely to get, or take into account that it was probably an alloy of copper and gold. And there have been some good engineers looking at the prop, coming up with estimates of, you know, 50 to 100 pounds. And that's more in line with the kind of the heft that people reported. One person who lifted it estimated maybe 60 pounds for its weight. And that's much more doable. But I'm surprised to see things of that nature still out there. Honeybees keeps coming up. No, the idea that there's no such thing as honeybees in the Americas, and the Book of Mormon doesn't necessarily claim that there were honeybees in the Americas. It's the Jaredites that had the honeybees back in the old world, but that's another story. There definitely are species of bees in the Americas that were there native, and some of the early Spanish writers talked about the bees that the Mayans or the Aztecs had. But there are issues that seem really petty that I'm just surprised to see. The adieu in Jacob. French wasn't a language in 600 BC. How can we have adieu in the Book of Jacob? So those keep making the rounds. And it's a little disappointing. Scholarship has not progressed there.
But Jeff,
there are plenty. Go ahead.
Don't you think that maybe a lot of little things like that add up to maybe a bigger thing, a bigger picture? Like maybe they just one little thing like that might be, oh, well, that's just petty. But when you have a lot of little things like that, doesn't it become more problematic?
No, absolutely. No question there. In fact, one of my early experiences in Wisconsin was with a young lady who had joined the church and then gotten a hold of a number of anti-Mormon books. And I forget which one it was. Might have been by Walter Martin. I don't know. But she was reading through a book and she said, well, she wanted to sit down and throw these arguments out. So she would throw out, you know, went through five or six reasons why she was convinced the church wasn't true. And we said, well, let's talk about them. And we went through each of those five and said, well, you know, that's a fair question, but here's, you know, what's wrong with that, or here's a reasonable explanation. Went through those five or six, and she said, well, I don't care if you have answers for all these things. Maybe you have answers for these things, but she pointed to the book and said, there are hundreds of arguments in this book, and if only 10% of them are true, then the church is false. And so, yes, I do recognize that the fact that there are numerous arguments that people can make and numerous questions that remain to be answered, perhaps, does create that sense of, oh my goodness, well, if only 10% are true, even if they can answer 90%, there's still that other 10%, and there's more than one. So let's weigh all of these issues. That's an approach people take. I don't think that's a healthy approach. Anybody practicing polemics or anybody pushing or spinning for one particular point of view in politics, religion, science, whatever it is, you can always pile on things. You can always, you know, start creating arguments. And if you want to create the impression that you've got 200 arguments against a case, you can do it. That's a popular tactic in debate when people are, you know, speaking as fast as they can to throw out all the arguments they can think of and pull through the five arguments the opposing side dropped, we win. I don't know if that's the right way to approach truth.
Jeff, you had mentioned a disparity between mainstream Christianity's perception of Mormonism as a Christian religion and Mormon's perception, which is fairly recent, as being a Christian church. Do you see the other side, though, when someone brings up things like Enish Goan Dosh and, you know, light coming from Kolob and, you know, the fact that Kolob itself is discussed at least 20 years ago within Mormonism is more of a space god instead of a Christian god?
That's an interesting question. Well, first of all, let me say that the perception that the church's emphasis on Christianity is I think there's no question that the church was focused on Jesus Christ and was about the gospel of Jesus Christ from day one. It was our enemies who were often called, you know, the Christians. It was the other Christian churches driving us out from, you know, New York and other places that to lead to this the language or the perception that, you know, it's the Christians against us. But the idea of us being Christian in the sense of we're following Jesus Christ as not necessarily the fourth century creeds, but we're following Jesus Christ, is from day one. And I think it's unfortunate that our opponents continue to paint us as having, as trying to do like a PR. This is simply a PR motivated spin to get more converts, that we're now, after all these years, turning around and trying to pretend that we're Christian, when that's what the Book of Mormon, that's what the First Vision, that's what the restoration of the gospel is all about, is Jesus Christ and bringing souls to Christ. This idea of the church being a space religion or a sci-fi New Age thing, I find both offensive and intriguing. It's intriguing in the sense that religion.
Well, if you find it intriguing, you certainly have to accept some of those, you know, quote unquote offensive beliefs. Would you agree with that statement?
Well, offensive beliefs in the sense that, well, a lot of that offensive belief system, to me, is accentuated, if not originated, from the God Makers, film and books and so forth that tries to portray us as believing and worshiping an extraterrestrial. And you can, I hope everybody worships an extraterrestrial in the sense of someone who doesn't live here on the earth. God is not currently living on the earth. By definition, of course, is extraterrestrial. But I don't see that as a sci-fi religion or a New Age religion.
So I guess to kind of pin this down, where does God live right now? Where does he physically reside?
I really don't know. We are told in the Book of Abraham that, and as you all know, there's this star that is mentioned somewhere called Kolob that's near to where God resides. So the idea of God residing somewhere in the universe is offensive to many people who have inherited the tradition of God being completely immaterial, or as the Catholic Encyclopedia says, wholly other. The idea of God being somehow in a physical body, I know that is troubling for some people. The idea of God being anthropomorphic, of us being physically in his image, is, I know, very troubling for some people. To those that are troubled by that, I would encourage them to go back and consider what the early Christians, as well as the early Jews, were experiencing and understanding. And the obvious fact that we can't get away from, that Jesus Christ was physically born. He was physically here on earth and physically resurrected. And that resurrection was so real and so important and so physical that he wanted to drive that point home by eating fish in front of his disciples, and swallowing it in front of them to show, and also telling them, touch me and feel and see. He wanted to drive this point home. He had a tangible physical body. And a fair question is, where is that tangible physical body now? I don't know. I do not know, but I believe it is somewhere. And
a lot of what was described to me, as I would describe Mormon, the more kind of mystical Mormon beliefs to other Christians, is it was bounced back to me that this is more of there's a lot more grounding in Mormonism within the Gnostic traditions or very bits and pieces of the Gnostic traditions of Christians and in the Kabbalistic traditions of the Jews. And I think that's what would go along with what you were saying.
Well, and certainly the fact that we have a temple, the endowment ceremony, the idea of temple being the house of the Lord, and there are rituals and ordinances to prepare us to return to the presence of God. So that does have roots that go back into that era. I I don't see it as Gnostic. I see it more as early Christian, early Jewish. And a great article just came out past couple of weeks. I think the top article on fairlds.org about the ancient Israelite temple, an ancient Christian participation in the Israelite temple. There is something there that is ancient and is very different. And I can see one of the difficulties I think we have, and you raise really an excellent point now that I think about it even more. One of the real difficulties we have with the LDS temple is it is so different and it is so foreign to our modern secular world. And Latter-day Saints are rarely prepared for it. And people outside the church are even less prepared for it as they, you know, read about it or see pictures of people wearing temple clothes or whatever it is. The idea of these ancient rituals and ordinances, this ancient pattern of covenant making in the LDS temple, and then the concepts and the heavy use of symbolism is very foreign for modern culture. And if people aren't prepared for that and don't understand, they're stepping back into an ancient world where there are different patterns and approaches and symbols, use of symbolism. If they don't understand that, it can be a troubling experience. If they do understand that, it can be a very testimony building experience. And just to highlight that, and this gets into some of the themes you mentioned, the two books I think that strengthen my testimony most in terms of respect for the temple as a restored ancient center for the gospel, and not just Joseph Smith's modern fabrication drawing upon elements in his environment. The two really helped me appreciate the ancient depth of the temple and its roots most, were books not written by LDS people at all. They were written by non-LDS scholars who probably knew very little of the LDS temple. Moshe Eliade, his book, The Sacred and the Profane, was just a tremendous eye-opener to me about the ancient world and the use of symbolism and the importance of temples and what they did in connecting the world of the living, the world of the dead, the world of the gods, being the sacred axis of the world, where the footstool of God, the altar, was, you know, a pivotal place, and all its symbolism. That was a tremendous step for me, is understanding these ancient roots and symbols. And then I followed that up with a book that's now out of print, unfortunately. I hope it'll be back in print someday. It's called Sinai and Zion, and it's written by Hebrew scholar John Levinson. He was at University of Chicago at the time. He's now at Harvard. John Levinson, a tremendous scholar, really deep and powerful understanding of the ancient ways of the Hebrews. And in this book, Sinai and Zion, he talks about how Mount Sinai, it was linked to the temple and the symbolism there. Everything from taking your shoes off on before the burning bush, and what Sinai meant and what that burning bush symbolized, and the covenant pattern. He got into ancient covenant patterns, and he brought out the work of George Mendenhall in the 30s on the ancient covenant formulary, drawing upon scholarship from the Hittites and other peoples, where they then found these same ancient patterns of covenant making in the Bible. And this covenant formulary, these six steps were discussed in John Levinson's book that go into these ancient covenants. And as I read that, while bells were going off in my head, I thought, my goodness, all six of these steps have them in the LDS temple. They were things Joseph Smith couldn't, to me, you know, in my opinion, couldn't possibly have fabricated or nailed right. It's one of those things like chiasmus, and you can argue all sorts of ways around it, but to me it was impressive. And other things, the symbolism, the role of water, the role of the font, the importance of, you know, clothing and dress and other things. His description of ancient Jewish covenant patterns and the symbols of mountains and temples and water and taming the chaos and conquering the waters of death and all these things, just the LDS temple seemed so at home in that ancient setting after reading Levinson's book. And those two books made me just increase my respect for the temple more than anything else I had read, and opened up a whole new level of awareness of what I need to do to appreciate the temple and prepare for and understand it and how to think about it. And I don't have those books with me right now because a very dear a friend of mine in Wisconsin, who has them right now. This friend left the church without my knowledge. I was away, or we'd lost contact for a little while, but she had left the church. I guess the person can't be that dear of a friend if they left the church without me knowing, but I consider them a dear friend. They left the church because they had some very basic questions about the temple that the people around her, the LDS people around her, couldn't answer, and just got the standard, well, you know, it's not a big deal, don't worry about it, you know. And I was just terribly pained when I realized that she had concluded it must be made up if she couldn't get answers and left the church. She's a smart woman, and I feel like, you know, based on what she knew and the poor answer she was getting, I can understand the decision she made. But when I told her, oh, wow, well, I gave her a quick 30-second answer to the question she had. She said, well, that's, I wish someone would have told me that. I want to know more. She started asking me all these questions about the temple and basics of LDS belief. And I'm very hopeful that she will reconsider in the future. It's her call, and I'll respect her regardless of what she does. But she is reading these non-LDS books about the ancient temple perspective that were so helpful to me years ago. And she's just very excited to be learning and getting answers that she didn't have before. And to me, the point is there are answers. And her story, to me, illustrates one of the reasons why I want to write, why I want to share my experiences, because there are good people out there who, because they're not able to get an answer, or they get a very bad or obviously incorrect answer, or a trivial answer, or because they don't even get an answer, just believe it's okay. There are good people who, puzzled, frustrated, sometimes angered, leave the church, and in my opinion, sometimes leave unnecessarily. And if only there had been answers or information for them to consider, they may have made a different decision. And I want them to know there may be more information, maybe other perspectives that they ought to be thinking about before they abandon. Because to me, my experience, the church is a tremendous blessing. And I have been just very, very fortunate to have it in my life.
So, Jeff, we've talked a little bit about some of the positive experiences you've had with members. But we know that as an apologist, sometimes you end up taking maybe a little bit unorthodox views. Sure. Have you received any sort of negative interaction with members for some of the things you've written or some of the things you've said, especially where you've
absolutely.
Maybe a little critical?
Absolutely. I had one person from Idaho write me a pretty stringent letter saying, by what authority are you making these interpretations? Does your bishop know you're doing this? And at that time, I was my bishop, so... had a good answer for that one. There have been some people that have been offended. There are some people that, you know, the issue of evolution is one. I'm very comfortable with the earth being old. I'm very comfortable with believing that even prophets and apostles do not become omniscient because of that ordination. I'm very comfortable with the idea that a lot of things happen because of human errors, and anytime you have humans, there's going to be something go wrong in the mix. And some people find those views not being faithful enough or not being supportive enough, and some people like to take a very literal interpretation of the scriptures that I offend them. There's all sorts of things. And to me, one of the things I really have enjoyed about doing a blog, this blog Mormanity, is learning the different perspectives others have and finding out, to my surprise, how easily offended many people are, or that's not quite the right word, how things I think are straightforward, simple, logical, can be very troubling and very disturbing to other people. And it's just really interesting. And it's helped me be a little more sensitive and to realize that some of the things we do and say in the church really can be destructive or harmful to other people. Not recognizing the pain that they may be in or the difficulty they have. I mean, if you're sitting around talking about, you know, temple marriage 24/7, and there are people that have really, you know, tried their best to be married, but it just hasn't worked out, that can be very painful. Or if you're talking about all the great miracles that you've seen in your life, and there are people that have been through similar challenges and the miracle wasn't there. This recently came up on the issue of why some children die and why some don't. And it's, if you've been through that, it's incredibly painful. And I haven't had one of my own children die. And it was a very good educational process for me to go through and understand how some of the simple stories we share can be really painful to other people. So there are all sorts of perspectives we have to think about. I do offend good Latter-day Saints, not intentionally, as well as people outside the church.
So the accusation has been made, and I accusation's probably too strong, and I'm thinking of John Charles Duffy in particular, that today the doctrine of the church is being driven more by apologists and people who are out there such as yourself than from the brethren. How would you respond to such a criticism?
I would say that that is far too flattering regarding the role of apologist. I think we are pretty irrelevant for the most part. In terms of the doctrine, I mean, to me, when I think of the doctrine, of course, I'm thinking of faith in Christ and the meaning of life and those type of things. But he may be referring, perhaps he was referring to interpreting details of like where the Book of Mormon might have taken place. Some of the getting into details, like what was the ancient American setting, if any, for the Book of Mormon. That's one where you're not likely to see the church come down and say, well, okay, guys, here's the map. Rather, it's one left to people to deduce and figure out, and that's a great area for apologists to enter the fray and try to understand it. If you want to understand the Book of Mormon, I think it's absolutely cool. Or to at least have, at least determine, is there a plausible ancient setting where it could have taken place?
I think the most telling change recently that came out from at least what is commonly occurring in the apologist discussions is that the recent change within the Book of Mormon's introduction, I think that was very, very telling of how much of an influence the discussion is having on the church itself. I think changing the introduction to the Book of Mormon was a huge change. I'm speaking specifically of the change from the principal ancestors
right.
change
to among the, yeah
right
and now it, I believe it's to among they added the word among or among the principal ancestors or?
Yeah, but the fact is it's changed now. When I was yes. you know, when I was a missionary and when I was teaching people, and I was taught that this was scripture, you know, this introduction was revelation, you know, and, you know, who knows, that might be just, you know, my experience and not necessarily the actual case, but that was something that in my mind was set in stone. And I think that the discussion that's coming from the apologists and, the critics, is having an impact on the church's actions.
If that's the case, then that is a healthy impact, and I'm glad we were able to get one word changed in the church publication because of this impact we have. And it is significant because, you know, I have been through myself. I've sat through many Sunday school lessons over the years where I've heard it declared as a matter of fact that all Native Americans are 100% descended from that boat of people that came over with Nephi and Lehi in 600 BC. Well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it really doesn't, because
even though Joseph Smith said that, I mean, my contention is that
see, I don't believe he said that.
Well, I think that's a little silly, but I think he did say that, and you know, I could pull it up and. We can. It's certainly, you know, an interesting discussion, nevertheless.
You know, I mean, Joseph Smith even specifically speculated on the Toltecs possibly having an old world migration source that would have been separate from the Book of Mormon peoples. I mean, the idea that there could have been no other migrations in ancient Americas, other than both the Jaredites, of course, and also the Nephites, doesn't really fit. The church is focused on that, and Sunday school teachers have focused on that, and the brethren have focused on that. But there were significant leaders in the church opening the door to non-Book of Mormon migrations to the ancient Americas long before the apologists started interpreting the DNA case for or against the Book of Mormon. We had, I think as much as a century ago, we had general authorities and general conference clarifying that or attempting to clarify that. Dallin Oaks was had made comments to that effect well before. I think it was Anthony Ivins. Anthony Ivins had an article about the ancient Americas and raising the question that there can be people that came from other places. So I think it's important that apologists have pointed out vigorously regarding this whole DNA thing in the Book of Mormon, that there clearly were other peoples in the ancient Americas, and the Book of Mormon never claims that there could be no other migrations or that nothing from Asia could ever have come here. In fact, Jaredites, Asia, could have accounted for a very interesting part of that whole thing. I don't want to get into the whole DNA Book of Mormon issue right now, but I think the apologists have played a significant role in reminding people of, or rather helping people to pay attention to what the Book of Mormon actually says and claims versus what we often assume about it when Sunday school comes around or when somebody gets up at the pulpit and starts talking. The Book of Mormon makes some very specific statements and does not rule out possibility of there being others. It's certainly very silent about them.
What do you think of the intellectual retreat that's common within LDS apologetics? Of basically, there is a cultural belief in Mormonism. Let's use the ancestors of the Lamanites example of all Indians being Lamanites, and then. Well, it changes over time. This certain little section was Lamanite, and there's other influences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you comment on that? You know, do you see this as kind of an I don't want to say intellectual dishonesty, though that certainly does come to mind, but kind of an intellectual retreating as a behavior of apologetics.
Well, yeah, if retreat is the right word, there are times when you really need to retreat. If you're interpreting something wrong and you realize there's a different interpretation that fits the data much better, it's time to retreat. I mean, a few hundred years ago, one could very naturally say, hey, the earth can't be more than, it must have taken 7 24-hour periods to create the earth. That's what the Bible says. And the earth must be only a few thousand years old. So when evidence comes out that, hey, the earth is really many millions of years old, billions of years old, what do you do then? Do you abandon faith or do you realize, oh, wait a second, that Hebrew word, yom, that can mean era. It doesn't necessarily mean a 24-hour day. And maybe this text is trying to tell us that the earth was done in phases that lasted some unspecified period of time. Oh, maybe it doesn't really have to be 7 24-hour. Okay, you can call that a retreat. I like to think of it as updating your understanding of the scriptures. And when it comes to Lamanites in the Book of Mormon, the easy, lazy thing to do is go with that old 19th century view that, hey, the Book of Mormon describes everybody in the ancient world. There were the Lamanites in the far south. There were the Nephites up north, and they were having battles across thousands of miles, and this describes everybody in the continent.
I think there's this clear differentiation in apologetics of religion and science. Whereas you can have, they want to have their cake and eat it too. And to say that a retreat is a acceptable behavior in a religious context, I mean, that really isn't, you're contradicting the two. If the science contradicts the religion, you can't have an ethical line. You know, there is no point of retreat, is what
I'm
saying.
Wait. I don't think that's quite what I was saying. If science provides information that challenges my assumptions about a religious text or assumptions about my faith and motivates me or even requires me to update that with that new information. I mean, okay. Take the 7 days. Is it 7 24-hour hours or 7,000-year periods or unspecified eons of time? The text doesn't actually say. People have assumed for centuries that it meant 24-hour periods when it said days in Genesis. When we learn that the earth is actually very old, is that contradicting my religion? It may be contradicting my interpretation of something from my religion. It doesn't necessarily cut at the core of my religion. I don't have to abandon Christianity if the earth is 5 billion years old.
But, well, to be specific, and we're talking about, you know, very specific things that were claimed about, you know, that Joseph Smith claimed and that other prophets claimed. It becomes very difficult to stay Mormon and yet deny that certain aspects of Mormonism are not necessarily true. Or there's wiggle room.
Mm-hmm. I know what you're saying. The fact that Joseph Smith or Oliver Cowdery. Now, I do not accept the claim that Joseph Smith said there could have been no other migrations to the ancient Americas. I don't know where that would come from. Equating Native Americans in North America with Lamanites has been done commonly in the church. And you can, does that mean, and this is a fair question, does that mean that whoever said that was claiming they were 100% descended from Nephi and Lehi? If so, they may have been wrong. If they were wrong, what does that mean for me as a Latter-day Saint?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
Right.
To me, that means somebody got that wrong. In my personal faith, I am willing to live with a Moses that could make mistakes, a Joshua that could be deceived by the Gibeonites in Joshua chapter 9, with a Gordon B. Hinckley that didn't immediately recognize that some documents from Hoffman were forgeries, and with a Joseph Smith that in his views and understanding of the world and his continent may have expressed things that weren't 100% correct, because I don't believe any of those men, because they were prophets of God or because they saw God or did some work of God, were therefore guaranteed to be 100% right in all their statements or their alleged statements, especially for the rest of their lives after that. I think Joseph Smith, let me be very blunt here. I think Joseph Smith made some mistakes in his life. He was not infallible. You can look at the Kirtland banking disaster. As an example, or even details on how polygamy was implemented. It's fair to wonder, could this have been done better? Was this a mistake? Nothing in my personal religion requires me to have an infallible Joseph Smith or an infallible Brigham Young or a Gordon B. Hinckley that can instantly recognize the provenance of any document he has shown. That's not my religion. And I don't feel like I have to defend Gordon B. Hinckley when he says something in a way I wouldn't say it, or when he doesn't catch something immediately, or Joseph Smith when he allegedly says something that seems silly. Not every statement from these people are canonized. Now, I do feel like I am responsible for what's canonized. And even then, and this will offend some Latter-day Saints, we can have canonized doctrine that we hold as doctrine that can be subject to errors. Anytime humans are involved, there's printing errors, there's errors of how we interpret it. There could be errors in the text. There have been errors in the Book of Mormon, and there probably still are some errors in terms of printing or other things in the text. And sometimes these errors or questions that come from human interaction can affect significant doctrinal issues. If you look at the manuscripts of the New Testament, there are some differences in at least three different an issue of adultery and being married to somebody or divorcing a person, does that count as adultery or not? That issue, there are three different sets of documents that could lead to quite different interpretations. Which one is right? I don't know. There's the possibility for human error at all levels. And that this is a very important thing Latter-day Saints need to understand. If you want to be a faithful Latter-day Saint and you want to explore the intellectual issues of the church and church history and your own faith, you need to be ready for a world that has a lot of fuzzy elements in it. Issues where there are human errors and human flaws and imperfections at every level, prayers that go unanswered, miracles that don't occur, tragedies of justice that occur, stake presidents that make mistakes. As a bishop who loves the stake presidents I've worked with, I know that they make mistakes. And I can tell you, when I was bishop, there were people who had every right to have their testimony challenged by some of the mistakes I made, because I, as a bishop, made some serious mistakes in spite of honestly seeking to get revelation and inspiration, made some serious mistakes. Anytime humans are involved, you have problems. And it's so important to me for people to understand our claim is not of infallibility, and it's not of a perfect church, and it's not of perfect leaders. We have a perfect Savior, and it's our responsibility to learn who He is and to recognize that in spite of all His perfections, there is a restored gospel of Jesus Christ that's there to help us come unto Christ. And that's ultimately what it's about. But otherwise, we've got to learn to have to live with this tension between our expectations and the natural disappointments and failures that come in this very human world. Sorry for that long rambling, but
that was great. Well, Jeff, our time has gone by and it's been a fascinating discussion. I have always found the inner workings of the apologist to be endlessly fascinating, and I think you've well represented your side and given us all a little food for thought. Thanks again for coming on.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for asking some excellent questions, too. It gave me some very good things to think about.
All right. So let's see. We have Mormanity.com or .org.
Or .org. Cyber Squatter got the .com before I
And then,
how do you spell that? Wait, Mormanity.
Mormanity.
And we'll put links up on our website. We also have JeffLindsay.com.
Yeah, it's S-A-Y.
S-A-Y. And do you have an email where people can contact you directly?
Yeah, just my name, jeff@jefflindsay.com.
Well, great. Thanks again, Jeff. It's been a pleasure. For those of you out there, if you want to follow up on the discussion, you can head over to the website at mormonexpression.com. As always, you can call and leave a message at 801-906-6722 or leave email at mail@mormonexpression.com.